Proposition 3 seeks to redefine marriage in the California Constitution. What changes would it make, and what implications would those changes have in our state? Plus, should only Christian values be considered, or are there societal factors to consider as well? I'm your host, Tess Abraham, and we'll be breaking down all of this and more on this week's episode of The California Conversation. This week, we are breaking out of our discussion of bonds and taxes, and we're shifting the conversation to something completely different. Although, this is another constitutional amendment, and last week we looked at a constitutional amendment, so maybe we're just starting a new trend. But before we get started, I want to remind you that I've compiled all the sources used in today's episode in a corresponding article on my website, which I'll link in the show notes. So check it out if you want to see where I get all of my information from. And while you're checking it out, please subscribe to this podcast and turn on notifications so that you never miss an episode, especially as we're just weeks away from the election in November. Now, let's dive into Proposition 3. Proposition 3 is a constitutional amendment that proposes changing the language in the California Constitution around marriage. Section 7.5 currently reads, "Only marriage between a man and a woman is valid or recognized in California." Proposition 3 would repeal this language and replace it to instead read simply, "The right to marry is a fundamental right." Simply put, Proposition 3 would remove the boundaries of traditional marriage from the California Constitution and would instead enshrine into law the concept that marriage is a universal right regardless of sexual orientation. To understand where this proposition is coming from, we really need to go through a brief history of marriage law in California. In 2000, voters passed Proposition 22 to add a provision to the Family Code, which is the set of laws that apply to family court in the state. The provision at the time stated that only marriage between a man and a woman is recognized in California. However, in 2004, Gavin Newsom was the mayor of San Francisco, and as mayor, he began to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Same-sex marriage was illegal in the state at the time, and so it caused controversy across the state, as gay rights activists praised the decision, while opponents were concerned over the mayor's disregard of the current law. The California Supreme Court ultimately halted and nullified the weddings just 29 days after they began. As a result of this, in 2004, 15 same-sex couples, along with advocacy groups and the ACLU Northern California, filed a lawsuit that was consolidated into what became known as the marriage cases. The marriage cases went through several court rulings and appeals before they ended up before the California Supreme Court. On May 15, 2008, the Supreme Court ruled that same-sex couples are guaranteed the same right to marriage that heterosexual couples have due to equal protection guarantees. This was the first change in the view of what marriage meant across the state. But this wasn't the end of the battles that were fought over marriage. As a result of the California Supreme Court's ruling, voters passed Proposition 8 later in 2008. Prop 8 added the language from Prop 22 into the state constitution as an amendment. So Prop 22 had been a statute, but Prop 8 made the statement of marriage being between a man and a woman an amendment to the constitution itself. This proposition passed with 52% of votes. The amendment was passed with the intention of reestablishing marriage as being between a man and a woman in light of the Supreme Court's ruling earlier that year. Originally, this amendment was upheld by the courts due to the fact that it created a carve-out in the state constitution, providing for an exception to the Equal Protection Clause. But another lawsuit followed. This time, it rose through the courts all the way to the federal Supreme Court, and in the end, the courts ruled that Prop 8 and the addition of the language on marriage was unconstitutional and could not be enforced. This was done on the basis, again, of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The decision became binding on June 26, 2013, and same-sex marriage was then legal in the state of California. It was just 2 years later, in 2015, that the Supreme Court ruled that the same reasoning applied to all states in the country, in the landmark Obergefell v. Hodges decision, thus legalizing same-sex marriage on a federal level. At this point, you may be asking yourself, why then does the California Constitution still have the wording from Proposition 8 in Section 7.5? Well, most states still have retained the original language on marriage in their constitutions. In fact, in 2022, 25 states still had both a statutory and constitutional ban on same-sex marriage, even though the bans were rendered unenforceable by the Obergefell decision. California is one of 5 states that has just a constitutional amendment ban on the practice. Supporters of Proposition 3 are then arguing that the language is outdated and not binding, which is why they're pushing forth the measure to remove it in line with the federal decision on same-sex marriage. Proponents include groups like the ACLU of Northern California, Equality California, Planned Parenthood, and Governor Gavin Newsom himself. These proponents also make the argument that the language should be removed in order to guarantee protection for same-sex marriage in the event that the Obergefell decision is overturned by the Supreme Court, which has not been brought before the court, but it has been a topic of discussion among activists since the court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. The argument is that if the courts could overturn Roe v. Wade, then they could potentially find precedent to overturn Obergefell, in which case the language in each state's constitution would become the law of the land. And if California still has it on the books that marriage is between a man and a woman, then same-sex marriage would once again become illegal. But is that the case? Well, I would argue that no, it actually isn't. Because first of all, the language in the state constitution was rendered unenforceable and discriminatory by the Supreme Court back in 2013, before Obergefell. So same-sex marriage was legal in California for 2 years before it was legal on a federal level. Second, President Biden signed the Respect for Marriage Act into law in 2022, which guarantees the right for same-sex couples to marry across the nation regardless of what happens with Obergefell. This act was passed for the same goal, to guarantee same-sex marriage cannot be outlawed in the states should the Supreme Court overturn the Obergefell decision. So, even if the decision was overturned, same-sex marriage would not be immediately outlawed in the state of California, regardless of the language that's currently in the state constitution. If we have a section in the Constitution that is rendered unenforceable, how is there still an argument from opponents of Prop 3 as to why that language shouldn't be changed? What are the arguments against taking it out of the Constitution? Opponents include groups like the California Family Council, Them Before Us, and the American Council of Evangelicals. They argue that first, removing the language is not necessary because of all of the reasons that I just described. But more than that, opponents of Prop 3 express concerns not just about removing the language, but more so about the language that would take its place. The Constitution instead would simply say, the right to marry is a fundamental right. However, these groups argue that it gives no definition of marriage, and it puts no restrictions on who can marry. This vague statement could open the door to arguing that other forms of partnerships, like polyamory or incest, are legal because it doesn't define who has that right to marry or what marriage is. By not just repealing language about marriage between a man and a woman, but replacing it with the assertion that marriage is a fundamental right, this paves the way for further changes to what marriage looks like across our state. But the consequences wouldn't end there, says Katie Faust of the organization Them Before Us. She argues that changing the definition of marriage puts the desires of adults over the needs of children, as changing the family structure will always affect the kids involved. Whether it's same-sex marriage, polyamory, or incest, all types of non-traditional unions have impacts on the family unit as a whole, which includes the children that are a result of that union, whether biologically or by adoption. So, are there any merits to these opposing arguments? Would this language change open the door to the situations that are described? Well, while it's easy to hear some of these arguments and see them as outlandish or maybe as things you don't think would really happen, they actually aren't all that far off. For example, when it comes to polyamory, both Oakland and Berkeley have passed regulations to legally protect multi-partner families. These protections assert that they protect polyamorous or non-traditional family arrangements from discrimination in housing, employment, healthcare, and immigration. Most importantly, they also extend to family courts, as custody cannot be revoked from parents for having multiple partners. So, if our state has already moved in certain districts to legalize and protect polyamory, it then doesn't seem too far off that vague wording in the California Constitution, which grants marriage as a protected right without any limits or bounds defined for it, could aid in soon recognizing polyamory as a valid form of marriage across the state. With all of that said, what then are we to think about Proposition 3? I first want to stop, and I want to address something before going any further. This proposition is unlike the previous propositions that we've looked at together. Issues like crime or rent control or government bonds are largely policy-driven, economic, or statistic-based issues. It's easy to break down the economics of how supply and demand works and then apply that to something like rent control, or dive into what problems are plaguing the public school system and what solutions could best address them. However, Proposition 3 is not like the others. When it comes to defining marriage, this is clearly a moral issue, not simply a legal one. How you view Proposition 3 will depend largely on your understanding of marriage, the authority you derive your morality from, and the principles by which you're convicted to live your life. The two are not inseparable. It's impossible to discuss a topic like marriage without appealing to morality, which in many cases means appealing to the religion or worldview that you hold. So, as I have made clear in previous episodes, I'm a Christian, which means that I derive my morality from the Word of God. I don't have the authority to define good and bad for myself, and I don't have the ability to redefine what God has already spoken on. Marriage is an issue that the Bible has clearly spoken on, and I'm bound to what God has defined as good. In the beginning of Genesis, we see that God is the one who creates marriage. From the very beginning, He establishes the boundaries and the definition of it. Genesis 2:24 says, "Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." Jesus affirms this design throughout the Gospels. In Matthew 19, He tells the Pharisees, "Have you not read that He who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, 'Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh?' So they are no longer two, but one. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate." It is clear from Scripture that marriage was designed to be one man and one woman forsaking all others and joining together in a covenant by the power of God, meant to be unbroken and unending in their lifetime. Why did God do this? After He creates this union in Genesis, He calls it good. He designed marriage this way for the good of the people involved, for the protection and establishment of the family unit, and for the good of society. And we see this not just for Christians or religious people, but we actually see this play out in society as well. Of course, as a Christian, my motivation is first and foremost to live by the Word of God and to defend what He has defined as good. So any societal argument is not as compelling to me. But it is still worth mentioning that the data does prove out that this design is good for society and should be compelling to all people regardless of your religious beliefs. To that end, I want to look at a few statistics and studies on the impact of the family unit within society, as well as what happens when we move away from the traditional family. The Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University, which historically is a more liberal-leaning institution, says, quote, "Most scholars now agree that children raised by two biological parents in a stable marriage do better than children in other family forms across a wide range of outcomes." What is this based on? If such a prestigious university as Princeton University is making this claim, what data supports this idea? They conducted a study on the decline in marriage where its authors opened with this statement, quote, "Although it was once possible to believe that the nation's high rates of divorce, cohabitation, and non-marital childbearing represented little more than lifestyle alternatives brought about by the freedom to pursue individual self-fulfillment, many analysts now believe that these individual choices can be damaging to the children who have no say in them and to the society that enables them." The study emphasizes the point that the family unit is important for a bigger reason than just marriage itself. It is important for children. Children suffer whatever effects are placed upon them by their parents. The organization We Are Donor Conceived have found that a majority of those conceived via sperm or egg donation see their conception as a core part of their identity, wonder what traits they have inherited from their donor, and feel as though they have an incomplete family history. Just under half reported feeling distressed, angry, or sad at the circumstances of their conception. Oftentimes, adults do not think about how these circumstances impact children. It's often said that kids are resilient and that they'll adapt. But this survey was created to give a voice to those who are donor conceived to express how their conception has impacted them, showing that it does, in fact, have an effect, even if they're able to adjust and adapt. In the same way, children are impacted by the families that they are raised by. Parents have rights to their children, but children also have rights to their parents. The United Nations recognized this right in its Convention on the Rights of the Child in 1989. What same-sex marriage does is it takes away the possibility of children being raised by both biological parents, as same-sex couples will need to use some type of donor or potentially surrogate to have children, and then it also takes away either the child's mother or father by raising them in a home of either two mothers or two fathers. But both mothers and fathers are important in children's lives. These assertions are backed by the U.S. National Health Interview Survey, which found that children raised in same-sex households were more than twice as likely to have suffered emotional or behavioral difficulties. It further reported that emotional problems, rated as definite or even severe, were nearly three times as likely in children who are raised in same-sex households as children who are raised in traditional households. Even beyond these statistics, there are countless personal anecdotes from individuals who are raised in same-sex households who describe their longing for a father or a mother. One such example is Millie Fontana, who was raised by lesbian mothers, but who is outspoken about her struggles with desiring a father as she grew up. She describes her experience as, quote, "The truth is that growing up with two mothers forced me to be confused about who I was and where I fit in the scheme of the world." The National Library of Medicine compiled a series of studies conducted by the Institute for Marital Healing, further confirming Millie's experience in others as well. They found that infants or toddlers most often preferred mothers to fathers when they were hungry, sick, or scared. Mothers, in turn, were found to be better at understanding their children's emotions, as well as distinguishing between their infants' cries than fathers were. On the other side, fathers were found to be better at providing both play and discipline to children, and children felt more safe and less afraid when their father was present. Despite this evidence that children experience negative outcomes when raised in same-sex households and their need for both a mother and father figure growing up, the narrative is often repeated that there is no difference in outcome for children raised in same-sex households versus traditional households. For example, the American Psychological Association asserted back in 2005 that there are no studies that distinguished any disadvantages of children raised by gay or lesbian parents. However, in 2012, a research study of the APA found that their claims were not scientifically based. This is because 26 out of 59 of the studies conducted by the APA on the topic did not include heterosexual comparison groups. And even in those where comparison groups were used, they didn't use traditional two-parent households, but rather used single-mother households. So the 2012 study could not substantiate any of the claims in the APA's 59 studies. The narrative that is touted by these organizations and is often believed in the mainstream is therefore backed by studies that have been largely debunked. It seems from research that there have been negative impacts on children raised in same-sex households and that children long for the presence of a mother and a father. As Christians, we may not need these studies because we know that only what God has designed is good. But the evidence further supports the idea that the nuclear family is a vital part of a child's life and that the breakdown of traditional family values does have impacts on those raised within alternative family structures. I just want to be clear about something here. I am not saying that people in same-sex relationships cannot be loving parents toward children. Hear me clearly, because again, I am not saying that if you are lesbian or gay, you automatically are precluded from being kind or loving or parental toward a child. But the reality is that mothers cannot replace fathers, and fathers cannot replace mothers. No matter how loving you are, you cannot escape that reality, and the data cited is proving it to be true. The reason why it is important to focus on children is because when it comes to how we're to think about Proposition 3, the question in front of us is not to evaluate if gay marriage is good, bad, or neutral. That's not what we're looking at. The question is, should the government, specifically for us, the California government, erase the idea that marriage is between a man and a woman and open it to any type of union? Your morality will dictate how you answer the first question, but the evidence of the impacts of same-sex unions on society should be the primary factor considered by the government when making policy. The government's main responsibility is to restrain evil and promote what is good, and it does that by defending the innocent and protecting the vulnerable. There is no more vulnerable group in society than our children. And matters of policy should not place the feelings or desires of adults above the real effects on children. Quoting Katie Faust once again, children of same-sex couples are denied a mother or father, have no connection to half of their extended family, and are alienated from half of their biological identity. This violates a child's right to their biological parents. Promoting the nuclear family is rooted in traditional values, but it is not spreading Christian nationalism, as some would like to say. Rather, it is the government recognizing the negative outcomes on society that certain lifestyles have and taking a stand in defense of those who will be affected by them. It also means being clear and precise in defining marriage, because opening the door to polyamory or incest is neither compassionate nor kind. Our government should promote the good in society, meaning promoting family ideals that lead to healthy marriages, having children, raising children in homes where they're proven to most thrive, and providing stability for individuals throughout their entire lives. Ultimately, we have to be reminded that these are the values that our nation was founded upon. Joseph Story, who is known as the father of jurisprudence and served as a justice on the Supreme Court in the 1800s, wrote, "One of the beautiful boasts of our municipal jurisprudence is that Christianity is part of the common law. There has never been a period in which the common law did not recognize Christianity as lying at its foundations. I verily believe that Christianity is necessary to support a civil society and shall ever attend to its institutions and acknowledge its precepts as the pure and natural sources of private and social happiness." Our society today has moved far away from these ideas, but our early government leaders saw Christian values as the underlying basis for good in our society. Lastly, you might be wondering, why does this matter if the language is already ineffective anyway? Same-sex marriage is already legal, so what does it matter if the definitions change? Well, first, I think that there is definitely weight to the arguments presented earlier that the language could open the door to include many other types of behavior as marriage. But I also have to answer this question as a Christian, because even regardless of societal good, which I believe there's much of here, I cannot ignore biblical truth, and no Christian should. Government is given its authority by God, and God has given us a clear definition of marriage. The government does not have the authority on its own to redefine what marriage is, because the government is not the independent arbiter of truth. God has defined what marriage is to be, and as a Christian, that means I uphold that definition, I defend that definition, and I cannot vote against that definition, no matter if the language is in effect or not. I know that for some of you, you may disagree with my values. I recognize because of different worldviews, you may not agree with my views on same-sex marriage. We can disagree. But I would challenge you to at least consider the statistics when it comes to societal impact and to define for yourself what the role of government is in shaping society. And if you do share my values, then my encouragement to you would be this: vote no on Proposition 3. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Every new listen or new subscriber really means so much to me. So if you're enjoying this podcast, please subscribe today and pass it along to your friends, your family, and your fellow Californians. You can follow me on social media at It's Tess Abraham, and you can find out more about the podcast at thecaliforniaconversation.com. I'll see you back here next week for another episode of The California Conversation.